I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. A recurring theme on this program is to look at Canada and ourselves. Over the last 5 years, we've looked at politics, the arts, literature, and now our food. A fascinating book is out now, What's to Eat? Entrees in Canadian Food History. It's edited by my guest now, Natalie Cook. She has brought together contributors who look at what we did and do eat, what our food says about us, and how it's evolved over the years. The book is more accessible than one might think. And once you've dipped into the pages, it's a fascinating gastronomic historical journey throughout the country, north and south, east and west, as well as from the past to today. Natalie Cook is Associate Dean of Arts at McGill University and editor of Cuisine, the e-journal of Canadian food cultures. The book is published by McGill Queen's University Press. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Natalie Cook. Good morning, Professor Cook.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. And how long has food been a focus of your academic work?
Actually, since about 2000. So I've been working on it for 9 years now in the Canadian context.
And how? So this book, I guess, comes about after much research, has it? Much writing in elsewhere?
In a way, it has. It actually evolved from a conference we held at the McCord Museum in Montreal in 2005 on the daily meal in Canada. And we had about 200 people join us in a conversation about iconic meals in Canada and what they told us about who we were and the kind of cuisine that we liked.
And now, is food history something that's been much written about over the last number of years?
That's a big question. The answer is yes. Especially in the North American context, we've seen some really exciting books coming out of the States. But there hasn't really been much focus on food history in Canada. It became an interest of cooks who cooked over open hearths in museum kitchens or actually taught people for restaurant cooking. And so we were seeing discussions of earlier Canadian meals showing up in the 1970s and 80s. But we haven't really seen a close look at what Canadians used to eat coming out of academic or scholarly texts or even texts that are a little bit more accessible like this one aimed at reaching a general audience. So this is really one of the first. There are a couple of other landmark books. Last year, Elizabeth Driver published a bibliography of Canadian cookbooks. It's a big tome that weighs in at about 10 pounds, and it actually hunts down all of the Canadian cookbooks in private and public collections that she could find. And the other one was a lovely coffee table book called A Century of Canadian Home Cooking by Ferguson and Fraser. And it's now out of print, sadly, mostly because it's quite costly. But that looked at some of the changing traditions in Canada over the decades during the 20th century. But with the exception of those two, this is really an introduction to the conversation.
No, I mentioned off the top that this is an accessible book. You did just as well for non-academics, especially. Was that the goal early on to bring this to say a general audience?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the whole idea is to spark up a conversation about what Canadians do eat and what we did eat and what our meals tell us about ourselves. So we have some chapters that I think. I mean, you're using the word accessible, but I think I would say engaging. So, for example, we have, at this time of year, there's a chapter on Thanksgiving. You know, so what are the differences in terms of the way we celebrate Thanksgiving in Canada and the U.S.? You know, obviously turkey figures in both of those. But, you know, where was the first Thanksgiving meal? Was it in the States? Was it in Canada? What did people eat on the first Thanksgiving meal? And how do, the differences between we celebrate, the way we celebrate Thanksgiving, the time of the year, and the kind of meals we have, what does that say about who we are and how we've chosen to do things?
And what did you find about what Canadians are or who Canadians are with regards to Thanksgiving that separates us, say, from our American friends?
Well, Thanksgiving, as you know, in Canada is celebrated in October rather than November.
Right.
And that's in large part because earlier on it was celebrated close to Armistice Day, so close to November the 11th. And then there was a real sense of national fervor that grew up around the Thanksgiving celebrations. And by 1921, those two holidays were actually combined so that they were celebrated at the same time. And it wasn't until 1931 that they were divided again, so that there was a real distinction between Thanksgiving as a kind of harvest festival and Armistice Day or Remembrance Day as a place where we remembered our nation and where we came to understand ourselves. So I think there was a real integration of a kind of nationalism in the way Canadians celebrated Thanksgiving in the early part of the 20th century. In the States, it was quite different. A linking, obviously, with the Pilgrim Fathers, you know, with that mythology that it began in 1621 with Plymouth Plantation. In actual fact, Jamestown claims that it was the first Thanksgiving was celebrated in 1607, right? So there's this wonderful debate about who was first. But that's very much a function of the feast and the harvest festival and the bounty. And it's not as tied up with a notion of nation as ours is in Canada. We also have a religious celebration here. You know that in Quebec, obviously, the Catholic population celebrates Action de Grâce, and it really does have a religious root in a way that the American perhaps does not.
So let's go back in time. Let's go back to the beginning of the country, whenever that was. The people who came here, the English and the French, how did they react to the food that the First Nations people ate?
Yeah, well, of course, the First Nations people are, in our sense, our first consumers, right? So those are the interesting food ways. It's quite interesting to look back at Cartier and his people. They were having a pretty rough time of it. And they were very loath to take on the food ways of the Aboriginal people that they were meeting at the time until they got really ill. And so, you know, if you ask what has Canada given to European food ways, or what was the new world able to give back to what we call the old world, Europe, it was really something that they picked up in that hard winter of 1535, when Cartier's men were dying essentially of scurvy, and they didn't know what to do, and they were given a tea made of the bark of white cedar, and they were miraculously cured. And so it was one of those turning points and discoveries for them. So they took back the seeds of the white cedar tree to France, and they called it the Tree of Life, so that, you know, as early as 1536, there were white cedars growing in the gardens of Fontainebleau that were considered the Tree of Life, and they came from our part of the world. They also brought back the sugar maple, so they were quite excited to see, you know, maple syrup and also the kinds of bounty of the sugar maple that's still our pride in this part of the world.
My sense of Canadian food and Canadian cuisine is that it's something that has evolved from over the years, from the people that have come here, whether it's the English, the French, or immigrants of later years. Is that what has emerged in terms of Canadian cuisine?
It's a combination of both. I think when I say both, there's been some continuity in Aboriginal food ways, and that's one of the things this book traces, that we're discovering the value of some of the traditional methods of harvesting food. So the Ōtaktān, the Aboriginal communities, taught us a lot, and we're seeing a return to that in the 21st century. But certainly there was new foods and that were brought to the new world. So I'm from Quebec, so I have to talk about tortière, right?
Yeah.
So, tortilla, in a sense, originated as a pie from Mesopotamia, right, and it traveled across the ocean as sea pie, and then it was translated into a French word, cipaille, which was a kind of transliteration of sea pie. So we brought this meat pie to the New World, and that's very much a tradition that we've inherited from across the Atlantic, and so that's something that we've brought new. On the other hand, kinds of things I was telling you about just now, the, you know, maple syrup and the bounty of the maple tree is something that we've given back to Europe, and so that's something that's been continuous right the way through, as have the kind of quality foods that we're learning now to really keep as part of our wealth of our land, you know, the salmon, for example, or the blueberries, the kinds of things that have been harvested for centuries, long before the French and the British arrived.
Is this the people in the old world, as you put it, do they recognize things like maple syrup as Canadian?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's funny, isn't it, to call it the old world when, in a sense, you know, the Aboriginals were in a much older world.
Right, right.
But absolutely. Maple syrup is now widely recognized as an incredibly high-quality ingredient. But there's some other iconic Canadian foods that I think probably don't hold us in quite such stead. Think of the donut, which has become iconic, certainly for Canada, probably spelled the American way these days. Beaver tails, you know, Canadian bacon. So there's some ingredients that have become distinctly Canadian, iconically Canadian, but that may not be associated necessarily with high quality.
And is poutine seen as Canadian or worldwide?
Yes, absolutely. Whatever the New Yorkers can do to it in terms of dressing it up and down. Yeah, no, for sure. In part because the cheese is so readily available here. It's very difficult outside Canada to emulate that cheese. Although, I think there's a restaurant chain in France now, isn't there, called Au Québec?
Right, yeah, I've read about that, yeah.
Yeah, that features poutine. And I think one of their difficulties is actually trying to emulate the quality of that cheese just to get the right taste. Do you like poutine?
Once in a while. Probably once a year I'll have it.
Right.
And I think that I find that that's enough for me, yeah. Over the scan of history that you've done, that you and your contributors have done in this book, were you able to figure out whether Canadians are experimental when it comes to food?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Actually, to our surprise, at first glance, we thought absolutely. I mean, certainly post-1967 in Canada, you see an incredible, exciting globalization in terms of tastes, right? So we're very proud of that in Canada. On the other hand, when we actually looked at turn-of-the-century cookbooks, we were surprised by the striking uniformity between the cookbooks. So we normally pride ourselves as a country with distinctive regional cuisines and a country that embraces innovation in terms of culinary techniques. But we were noticing some suspiciously similar recipes named very differently. So, for example, the Manitoba pudding, for example, in a Quebec City book looked very like the Montreal pudding in the Toronto book. And the Muskoka chocolate cake in the Toronto book wasn't the same as the Muskoka cake in the Victoria book. So there was some slipperiness in terms of naming of recipes that showed a kind of continuity across the country. So it was as though cookbooks were speaking to one another and individual home cooks were sharing recipes across the country and across regions. So in a strange way, I'd actually probably say no, that what we discovered is that we were more conservative than we expected, and there was more sharing of traditions than we were expecting.
But the different names, though, that speaks to our identity issues, doesn't it?
Yes. It also speaks to a fierce sense of pride in the local and the regional that we saw appearing even at turn of the century. So it's become very faddish to emphasize the local, certainly since the slow food movement. I think there's a value in that. But we were seeing it in Canadian cookbooks early, you know, even before the turn of the century, that cookbooks were very proud to be talking about the recipes that were developed in their particular, you know, region or locality. And so that was quite exciting, especially since there's so many community cookbooks, at least in English-speaking Canada.
Now, I'm curious about the immigrant experience and how that has shaped Canadian cuisine. I'm sure you know that in England, tandoori chicken has replaced, I guess, beef and potatoes as the English people's favorite meal there. Do we see something like that in Canada?
I think we're starting to. At the same time as we were seeing the kind of uniformity across cookbooks, we're also seeing evidence of the impact of immigrant communities. So, for example, turn of the century, out in B.C., we start to see Chinese recipes that are evidence of the increasing Asian population out in B.C. So even in 1909, for example, we see a section on Chinese cookery in a gas company cookbook coming out of Vancouver. But if you did an overview and you looked at the Canadian cookbooks and you looked at the moment when we see immigrant and ethnic foodways starting to appear, I think most people would point to the 1950s. And that's interesting because that's the same moment that we think of foodways as becoming increasingly homogenized across North America. So in Canada, we're seeing both. We're seeing an adoption of what I'll call American foodways here, but that, you know, an industrialized notion of foodways that is shared across North America, but also a real increasing pressure to produce specific foodways that give those who participate in the meals access to a sense of a home country and a specific ethnic foodways tradition.
Now, you mentioned that you got to look at a number of cookbooks throughout history, and that helped buttress the research for the book. Did you get a chance to look at restaurant menus?
I actually haven't looked at restaurant menus a lot. There's a wonderful collection here at the McCord. It's probably worth mentioning in case anyone wants to explore them. Our book is primarily focused on meals that produced and consumed in the home. So it's really focusing on the daily meal as opposed to the meal that's eaten out. With one exception, we've got a chapter on Chinese foodways, and that actually focuses a little bit on restaurants and menus just because of the importance of the Chinese cafe, you know, across Canada during the early days. So we're really focused on the home cook and the home meal, which is a little bit different.
And if we went out for Chinese food, it would usually be, I guess in the past, it would have been at a restaurant rather than at home.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's very, I expect a number of us have become very excited about Chinese cooking recently, but it would be very unusual to consume it or produce a Chinese meal at home unless you were Chinese.
Right.
But on the other hand, you know, as early as the railways, there were Chinese restaurants dotted in small towns across Canada. It's really, you know, one of the fascinating pieces of our heritage. There's some amazing photographs of Chinese restaurants and the individuals who founded them across Canada.
Now, taking us to a contemporary context, we get a number of cookbook authors, chefs and the sort on this program talking about their latest book. There seems to be a trend for more local eating, more organic eating. Is that years from now when we look back at today and when we look at the cookbooks of today, is that what we'll see in terms of our habits of today, that we're trying to make a change perhaps nowadays?
I think so. I think we're going to look back at this particular decade and think about our focus on sustainable foodways. And the irony of this is it's a return, as I think, a return to very traditional foodways. So we have a chapter by Marjorie Fee on foodways of the First Nations, and it's really focusing on some of the traditions that disappeared but that we're trying to reestablish now in the 21st century. Also, our interest in heritage foods and heritage grains is another example of this. You know, we have a chapter on red fife wheat, which is a heritage grain that was out of favor for a long time, but is really coming back on the scene. And I think Weston Bakery at the moment is actually experimenting with how to use it on a larger scale. So we're going to be seeing this heritage grain, which was really brought back through as a labor of love by a number of people who wanted to bring back this traditional foodways. And I think we're going to start to see that coming back. So if we think of the 1970s as the diet decade and the 1980s as a return to, you know, a wide range of different foodways, we'll think of the first decade of the 21st century as a real concerted effort to go to look at sustainable foodways.
You mentioned earlier 1967. And just as an academic, whether you're looking at literature, politics, or art, I'm sure the literature on that and at the time on Canada was quite large. In terms of cookbooks and the sort, there was a great boon then.
Mm-hmm. 1963 is actually a date that people often mention that. Generally, in terms of the food world, there's a kind of sea change that occurs as individuals look to a more globalized way of eating. And it's, you know, think of Alice Waters in California or Julia Child, who published, you know, Mastering the Art of French Cooking in 1961. In Canada, it's 1967, and it's Expo, which galvanizes the attention of the world as Montreal welcomes the world to its doors, and it also welcomes the foodways of the world into the Expo site, so people are exposed to those foodways. at the same time, there's this incredible boon in publishing. So Jean Benoit decides to publish a book that looks at Canadian foodways. Pierre and Janet Burton take a look at it. Sonia Gottlieb take a look at it. So that as a result of the centenary celebrations, a number of these writers really focus their attention on what should or is Canadian cuisine. And what they come up with is a kind of a notion of a nation of regions. And so these books actually talk about almost quilting together regional cuisine. And they're fabulous books, but they're paradoxical because they talk about a national cuisine on the one hand, and on the other hand, they say the national cuisine is made up of these regional cuisines. So they try and have their cake and eat it, too. So the publications of that particular period are a really interesting study in Canada trying to come to a grips with itself and what its foodways and the things it was doing in terms of its kitchen tables and dining was saying about itself. Rona Keneally has a terrific chapter on Expo and the impact of Expo on foodways and what it can tell us about our own sense of ourselves.
Professor Cook, this has been a fascinating conversation and a fascinating book. You've done a great service adding to and starting this conversation on us. Congratulations on the book, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, and thanks for having the conversation with me.
Hey, you're very welcome. The book is a terribly engaging book. It's called What's to Eat? Entrees in Canadian Food History from McGill Queen's University Press. It's editor Natalie Cook on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.